This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Gagne. And today I'm talking to a whole bunch of people about a new anthology that just came out with Vanderbilt University Press called Sex in the Middle East and North Africa. Today, we're going to be talking to the two editors of the collection, Angel Foster and Lisa Nguyen, as well as one of the contributors, Mina Ibrahim. I am also a contributor to this text, so I'm really excited to be having this conversation today. But let's not talk about me. Let's just keep it to the guests. So just by way of introduction, Angel M. Foster is professor in the Faculty of Health Sciences and the 2011 to 2016 endowed chair in women's health research at the University of Ottawa. She's also the co-founder of Cambridge Reproductive Health Consultants. Lisa Nguyen, who publishes under the name LL Nguyen, is a professor of anthropology in the School of Social Sciences at Macquarie University in Sydney and previous president of the Australian Anthropological Society. She's also currently an associate editor of the journal American Ethnologist. And Mina Ibrahim recently completed his PhD at the University of Gießen in Germany and is currently a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Marburg, a research affiliate at Zentrum Moderner Orient in Berlin. He's also the project coordinator of the MENA Prison Forum and the founding director of Shubra's Archive for History and Social Research. Welcome all. I'm really happy to have you all here today and to be talking about this new collection that's coming out that's several years in the making. I'm really excited for this collection. I've already got one of the readings on my Anthropology of Gender class for this semester, so I'm really excited.
Which one is that?
Oh my God.
Now I put you on the spot. Just tell us the general, you don't need to know the exact title, just tell us the general topic.
It's the one about women in Iran and their use of sex toys and pleasures and piety.
Oh yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, it's a really good chapter. So let's just begin. We're going to, I have a couple of questions sort of first contextualizing the book and sort of asking about the overall frame of the book that you guys established as editors. And then I have some particular questions about your individual contributions. And so I just want to start with contextualizing the book. And so this book is a sort of a sequel to a book that you guys published or you edited a few years ago called Abortion Pills, Test Tube Babies, and Sex Toys, Emerging Sexual and Reproductive Health Technologies in the Middle East and North Africa, also with Vanderbilt University Press. And in the introduction, you sort of talk about how that book sort of paved the way for this book. And so I'm hoping that you could tell me a little bit about how the writing and the reception of that book paved the way to new questions and new lines of inquiry that led to this book. And this is for Angel, yeah.
Sure. Well, first, Matthew, thank you so much for putting together this podcast. It's really a delight to be able to talk about this new book. Lisa and I have been working together for a really long time. At this point, I think it's going on 2 decades. And in 2017, Vanderbilt University Press published Abortion Pills, Test Tube Babies, and Sex Toys. And that book was really a labor of love that had taken many years to get together. The book focused on specific reproductive health technologies in the Middle East and North Africa, and it was structured such that each chapter focused on a technology and a particular country. And we divided that book into 3 sections. We had a section on contraception and abortion technologies. We had a section on sort of pregnancy-related technologies. And then there was a section that was on sexual health and sexuality technologies. And that section included, for example, a chapter on sex toys in Morocco, and a chapter on the HPV vaccine in Lebanon, a chapter on hymenoplasty in Iran and Viagra in Egypt, and gender transformation practices in Turkey. And once the book was released and we started to get reviews of the book, we started to, you know, tour a little bit about the book and share information about the chapters, it was very clear that the sex part was the thing that people were most interested in. People were fascinated by the chapters that were included. They were really excited to learn more about how technologies and sex were intertwined. I think those chapters really broke down or moved away from some of the preconceived notions or stereotypes that sometimes readers have about sex in the Middle East. And that's really what spurred us to take on this as a dedicated project. I'll also say that one of the things that came up in the reviews that both Lisa and I found really compelling was a critique of the book that said that we really, that what was missing and what would be valued was to be, was to have a book that explored a greater range of sexual behaviors and identities. And so when we approached this book, we really leaned into that critique and tried to ensure that the book was more reflective of the full range of experiences.
Let's turn toward then that topic of sex, because this is something that is, you know, part of my research agenda. And I know that Lisa's published, you know, she has a monograph from 2018 that sort of also talks about this. And you guys are talking about it in the introduction, which is thinking anthropologically about how to study sex, right? And how to contextualize, how to study it, but also how to contextualize it in a region like the Middle East and North Africa. And so, you know, one of the first questions that came to mind, or one of the first topics that you really try and get to, is the politics of studying sex from that region and about that region. So can you tell me a little bit about how in the introduction there, you guys sort of connect the book to a genealogy of writing about sex and sexuality in the Middle East and North Africa? Lisa,
Yeah, no, it's a good question, Matthew. I mean, both Angel and I are anthropologists. Angel is additionally, she works in public health and she's a physician. But as anthropologists, you know, both of us are hyper aware of the history of anthropology writing about the sex of exotic others. So if you look at historically, like Margaret Mead was one of the most famous anthropologists, and she came to fame because she was writing her book Coming of Age in Samoa, where she was talking about you know, young people, young adolescents, and their pursuit of sexuality outside of marriage. And she was really doing that to use this other society as a kind of a critique of her own society. She was bisexual, and she was writing in an era where the sexuality was fairly repressed and heteronormative and within marriage. And she just saw what was happening in this other society as being so much healthier for the individuals involved and for society in general. And so she's part of this long legacy of writing about sex. But when it comes to the Middle East, it's quite different because for some reason, you know, the Western world has always been super fascinated and titillated, you know, by the idea of sex in the Middle East. You know, there's this long history of colonial writing about harems and veiled women And so we were super aware of that. And we wanted to unsettle that. But at the same time, we had to stay aware that that was part of what would generate the audience for our book, you know? So it's a strange bind to be in. On the one hand, you want to disrupt those colonial fantasies about the other, about their weird and exotic sexual practices. And by the way, if you look at the history of Western writing about sexuality in the Middle East and North Africa, it kind of plays this role of the reverse of whatever the writer's sexuality or in their own society is like. So at a time when Western sexuality was fairly repressed and heteronormative, there was a lot of writing about like the Middle East as if it was this place where a lot of weird stuff was happening. You know, the Sultan in his harem with a whole bunch of concubines, just having like, you know, I guess people imagined wild orgies or something. And then as Western sexuality became a little more open in the 70s and so on, then all of a sudden the depictions of the Middle East flipped to become the opposite. And now it was the land of the sexually repressed, you know? So that's really interesting. That tells you something. That tells you that we're not just writing about the sexuality of others. We're always writing about the sexuality of others with respect to ourselves, or as a foil for thinking about sexuality in our own society. So Angel and I were really aware of that, and we found it a tricky position to be in. And we decided that the only way to really deal with it was by, you know, dealing with it head on, by saying, yes, we know that there's this history, and here's how we're going to try to get past it. But on some level, we can never get past it, because we know that that Western imagination and fantasy of Arabs, for example, you know, having lascivious sex in the harem, that's always going to be in the background of what any reader is thinking about as they read this. And hopefully the many chapters in the book will unsettle that a little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. And you know, you really do rely a lot on, you know, Said's Orientalism and intellectual traditions around those topics, which relates to that idea of the very, that particular relationship between, you know, Europe and Western culture and the Middle East as this sort of like, you know, Europe used the Middle East as a mirror of its own self, right? As a way of defining itself through these depictions of the region, which is very different from its relationship to other regions in the world. So yeah, it's interesting. That's such a distinct part of the implications of anthropological studies of sex in MENA, as opposed to in other parts of the world, like you say, because even Malinowski had his text, right, where he just documented the sexual practices of that society, just as a way of
which
of,
he called the savages, right? The sexual lives of savages.
Exactly. And it's just like, it's pure documentation as a way that's just all about that othering. And so I'm curious for, you know, this is a question for Angel. I mean, how does this book situate itself within that tension? Because like Lisa pointed out, it's hard to get away, like, it's hard to get a, and in the introduction, you point out the fact that like, as writers in this book, we're all participating in that legacy, and it's hard for us to get away from that legacy. But it's also important that we try to get away from that legacy, or we try to sort of interrupt it or intervene in some way. And so I'm curious how you guys sort of locate the text within it.
It's a great question. And it's a struggle, and it's an ongoing effort. I think that one of the things we really tried to do, and you know, part of this was having just some wonderful contributing authors who were doing really fascinating work, but then working with them individually to really make sure that the claims that are being made and the kinds of things that are being said are not overly generalizing, that they're very located in the specific ethnographic work that someone's doing, that positionalities and reflexive practices around positionality are infused within these chapters. And I think that is a first step in trying to address this, really locating the author. And we have authors who are from the communities that they're writing about. We have authors who are deeply embedded with the communities that they're writing about. And we have authors who are quite distant in some ways from the communities that they're writing about. And all of those perspectives can be valuable and rich. I think it's important, though, that people own what those perspectives are. And so I think we really tried to work across chapters to ensure that that was part of it. I think the other thing, and I will say, I think this is true in general about the way that sex is written about in academia. I think this is especially true in public health, although we do sometimes see this in anthropology as well. We don't talk about the pleasure and the fun and that kind of element of sex, the positive elements of sex. So often the focus in academia is either very dry and in a very public health kind of domain, or it's about the horrors of sex or the risks of sex or the dangers, or it's contextualized around violence. And I think one of the things that we really try to bring forward in this volume is some of the things that are fun and pleasurable and that we see as being very human, cross-cultural, not unique necessarily to the MENA region, but not something that is often the focus of discussions of sex and sexuality within the region. So that was another, I think, aim for us.
Yeah, and I'll just add, I remember one of the early reviewers of the text saying, well, you know, this is all good, but what about sexual violence? You know, and we felt like, yes, I mean, that's a reality of people's sexual lives around the world, but it's also a big part of the stereotypes that many people have of the region. And we just didn't want to go there. And like Angel said, we wanted to write about sex as pleasure, sex as joy. So there are some hard stories in there. You know, it's not all like happiness and joy and fun and pleasure. I mean, there's also stigma and shame and, you know, but we really wanted to try to find that balance and look at people, you know, actually enjoying sex and enjoying their lives and other people and their bodies.
Mm-hmm. So now the book itself is divided into three sections that very humorously, I think, mirror, and you guys point this out, this isn't my observation, but sort of mirror contemporary social media relationship categories, right? Can you describe the narrative sections and the sort of idea behind the story you're trying to tell through the sort of sections of them?
Sure. So we divide the book into three sections, single and dating, engaged and married, and it's complicated. And we do that for a couple of reasons. I think first is just a general compulsion among academics to categorize and organize things in ways that we can then guide a reader to making connections between chapters and ideas. So that's certainly part of the trifecta that we've included. But we really did want to both acknowledge the way that we think about different kinds of relationships and how that gets categorized often on social media, but also then one of the themes I think that comes out in many of the chapters of the book is the role that information technologies, the way that social media, the way that new media influences people's engagement around sex, whether that's how people meet sexual partners or prospective partners, or how people find out information about where it is that they can go in order to have in order to engage in sex in ways that are safe and socially protective, or how it is that people navigate health systems and needs that are around that are adjacent to or around having sex. And so in organizing the book in that way, we wanted to highlight that one of the kind of transcendent themes of the book is the way that the internet, information technologies, and social media is playing in the contemporary Middle East.
And that actually
contemporary everywhere, right? Like, yeah. That's not unique to the Middle East.
And that connects up to your chapter, Matthew, which I know you said you weren't going to talk about, but maybe you should say something. I mean, it's a great chapter and it's all about, you know, hooking up and using dating apps, right?
I mean, one thing that I've struggled sort of more broadly in my research and particularly writing it is that relationship between the particularity and the sort of the universality of intimate life and sex and desire and pleasure and dating and, you know, in the digital age. And you know, it relates to what you were saying, Lisa, about imaginaries that we have around the region. So often when I wanted to talk about dating apps, I wanted to establish sort of like a universal theory of dating apps through, you know, the particularity of men in Beirut. But people were always like, no, what is it about Beirut? It was always that story of like, no, make it about Beirut, not about the apps. Whereas I sort of often wanted to make it about the apps, because at the end of the day, it's that line where I can say this is about Beirut and this is just about the apps globally is very, very blurred.
Well, I was going to say, so many of us are writing in the tradition and in the legacy of Leila Abu Lughod, who published this really influential chapter a few decades ago called Writing Against Culture, right? Where she basically said, you know, what anthropologists need to do is not say, you know, this is the culture of Lebanon, this is the culture of Beirut, you know, but instead to focus on the particularities of people's lives in a way that we could then understand how, sure, there are cultural norms, but there are also people who are constantly going against them or working within them or doing interesting idiosyncratic things that actually reveal how culture works, but also how culture changes. And so it's a balance, right? Because there are things that apps do, you know, broadly speaking, outside of culture. They, you know, technological configurations make people interact in particular ways. But then,
The thing with apps is that at the end of the day, they work the same anywhere. And so the effect they're having globally is actually one of similitude, right? Like, so often queer men in Beirut, men around the world, at least in my, you know, research realm, they can go anywhere now and just find sex within 10 minutes because the idioms, the practices, the ways of communicating, they're all becoming similar as opposed to different. Of course, there's local variety in terms of the kinds of words that people use, the meaning behind those words, the speed at which they hook up, the anonymity that they might want to retain. You know, in Beirut, discretion is higher than in Toronto, but men in Toronto are still discreet, right? Like, so this idea that discretion is a characteristic of a Middle Eastern city, it doesn't hold true as much. You know, it's hard to make that analysis because at the end of the day, you could travel to any city and open Grindr and find people who are withholding information because they're trying to be discreet. So it's such a fine line in terms of where culture is really playing a role in the production of the localized meaning versus the universality. And this goes into that category. For me, the way I think about it is how, at least when it comes to talking about queerness and the digital age, how that category of the Middle East or of the, you know, the Lebanese queer man gets produced against assumptions about the violence and problems of being queer in Lebanon, because those are undeniable. That the kinds of political limitations and violences and oppressions that exist there certainly, you know, shape how they use the technologies. And so how it reifies, I always just had people, like, when I would tell people, oh, I study these apps in the Middle East, they're like, aren't you afraid? Aren't you? And it's, you know, there's all these sort of reifications of those categories and the assumptions that come with them. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same for me doing my research, you know, talking to people who are basically sex workers, right? Although they don't think of themselves necessarily in that way. And everybody's always shocked, like, what? You know, how can you do that? How are they not getting arrested? And I just have to explain, people's lives are really complicated and interesting and nuanced. And people find ways in and around the normative categories that try to constrain them to do really interesting things with their lives.
Also, just to piggyback on something that Lisa just said, I'll also just say that one of the things that we really wanted to try to do with this volume overall is problematize this idea of binaries. Binaries where something is licit or illicit, where something is, you know, acceptable or unacceptable. Binaries around gender identity, binaries around sexual orientation, binaries around, again, binaries around the way that we construct what is and isn't permissible. And really talking about how something that's using terms that come up a lot, what's socially normative versus what's non-normative, and how those lines are really blurry. And I think that's one of the things that we really, that's really a strength of this book, is that it complicates a lot of those bright lines and suggests, actually, they're really not that bright. And what this means is very much dependent on context. And as Lisa mentioned, people's lives are complicated and interesting and multifaceted. And I think there's a tension there, but it's one that I think we've also, again, tried to lean into and really explore.
And the stories aren't so different from stories that one might hear from other places and in other contexts and stuff. Yeah. Yeah. So, who should read the book? Who's your imagined audience?
Gee, why do I find myself stumped when you ask that question? I mean, everybody, duh. Look, I mean, there's a lot of interest in this topic, in the topic of sex in the Middle East, in North Africa. And we saw that when that book came out, Sex in the Citadel, right? Which was a great, more popular approach to the topic. And now, we're academics, so we're not writing this in a journalistic style for, your everyday person on the street. But I think it's accessible to people who are willing to deal with our citational practices. They're really engaging stories that people tell. I mean, we asked our contributors, we said, tell stories, tell us about people's lives. Don't just turn this into a theoretical essay. So it's really engaging. I think that people will do like you're doing, Matthew, and they'll assign a chapter or three, in a class that they're teaching. I think people will pick it up just to read about the astonishing variety of sexualities and sexual practices and lives in the region. I don't know. What do you think, Angel?
I agree. I mean, I think we very intentionally wanted the chapters to be relatively short. These are not super long chapters that take forever to navigate. We wanted them to be more accessible. I think that for a number of different reasons, we really did ask contributors to elevate the voices of their interlocutors, to really try to tell people's stories and bring that out. I think that makes for very engaging reading. I expect that this kind of book would be particularly resonant with undergraduates who are in area studies or anthropology, even in public health, feminist and gender studies, in part because some of the things that are in this book are quite universal. And I think, a North American undergraduate is likely going to relate to a number of the things in this book very viscerally and very directly in a way that might have been surprising to them had you said, I'm going to assign you a chapter on sex, something about sex in the Middle East, to then read this and say, actually, I see very much things about myself, my own community, my own experience in these works. And so I think that could be particularly valuable.
Yeah, like the chapter that you co-wrote, Angel, about hooking up in Jordan, I mean, like these things are really, it's not just the exotic practices of the other, right? It's really connected to our lives.
There are some things that are really, that are very specific to individual settings. And I think about, the chapter that really looks at legal sex work in Tunisia that I think will be very surprising to a lot of people who don't know about that history of the legalization of sex work in Tunisia and then what happened after the revolution. And I think things like that will appeal to a number of different kinds of audiences. I will say that one of the things we very intentionally tried to do with the book is incorporate chapters from different parts of the region. As someone who's very much a North Africanist, I did my doctoral and postdoctoral work in Tunisia. Often the Maghreb is excluded from collective works about the Middle East that tend to focus more on Egypt and the Levant. We're really excited that this book really is about the Middle East and North Africa, including having contributions that are about Turkey, Iran, the Gulf, the Levant, Egypt, and then the Maghreb. And I think that's something that for folks in area studies, I think could be particularly valuable as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. So let's move on to a couple questions for each of you about your individual contributions. So the first is Angel, and like you say, the chapter that she co-wrote, which, you know, like you say, it's a very narrative-driven, interesting, insightful chapter about apps and casual sex among heterosexual women in Jordan. Can you tell me about the basic demographic culture shift that you're exploring here in the chapter?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think one of the things that we were trying to do with this chapter is to really look at how there's been a shift in changing sexual behaviors and marriage patterns around heterosexual women in Jordan, and we see this in other parts of the region as well. Heterosexual women are spending more and longer and longer periods of their lives outside of marriage. They're getting married later. They're also engaging in a number of different activities and environments that where they're having more social interactions and opportunities for sexual relations than, you know, would have occurred decades prior in a very different kind of in a very different era. And again, that's not unique to Jordan. This is something we see all over the world. But there's this often imagined idea that these changes aren't happening in the Middle East, that you're not seeing, you know, heterosexual single women having sex before marriage, and then instead they're just celibate for a really long time, or, you know, we just don't talk about what might be happening. And so for this chapter, we really wanted to look at these kinds of competing desires, these competing both sexual and social desires, but then also competing issues on how to navigate family and community and sort of social expectations that perhaps are more conservative in some way than people's individual behaviors, and how it is that they are finding space to hook up, have casual relationships, and then also navigate through health systems, for example, to be able to get care when the health system has been structured over a very different model that really doesn't recognize that unmarried people have sex for pleasure. And so I think that chapter is probably one of the more public healthy chapters in the book, although it's very qualitative in its orientation. But I do think that is a chapter that's really trying to ask readers to, you know, to recognize that the same kinds of shifts that we've seen in sexual behaviors in many other places of the world, including North America, are also occurring in the Middle East in very similar constructions. And technology plays an important role in that, both in how it is that people meet and how it is people navigate whatever systems they need access to.
Yeah. So can you just, you know, for the sake of entertainment, can you give us some of those details that you talk about in the chapter, particularly around, you know, you talk a little bit about how it's shifted the interactions, the way these women interact with men, or the kinds of new opportunities that women have created through these technologies?
Yeah. So I'll start with the opportunities part, which is this can allow people various kinds of dating apps and social media platforms can allow people to meet others who are like-minded, who are interested in pursuing a more casual or at least outside of marriage sexual relationship, and do that within some sort of some ways that are protective, and figuring out that this is someone who might be a match, and being able to figure out how to meet someone in ways that could be comfortable, that allow people to interact and try somebody on for size without feeling like there could be a lot of exposure in one's larger social environment. I think the other thing, though, that we really documented here is that some of the things that women in Jordan were sharing with us about their experiences engaging on social media are the same things we've heard in other places. we have a whole section on the unsolicited dick picture and what it means when, you know, people are engaging in these spaces and then suddenly getting pictures of genitalia that was surprising, unwelcome, upsetting, and trying to figure out what that means and how to navigate that. So on the one hand, these apps and this technology provides this sense of safety in being able and protectiveness of being able to pursue these kind of more casual sexual relationships. And on the other, there's these exposures to things that are quite unsettling and figuring out how to navigate that. I think one of the things that we heard, which again, without wanting to all the things I said before, without wanting to make things too universal, but one of the things that I think we heard in this is that often people think they're the only person who's experiencing this. So when we're talking to women in Jordan and they're talking about the dick pic scenario, it's often someone who's feeling like, what did I do to bring this on? Because it must be about me. It must be a signal that I'm sending, and what do I need to do to deal with that? As opposed to saying, actually, this is something that's a much broader phenomenon, and it's about how people all over the world, and in this case, women in particular, and heterosexual cis women in particular, are navigating this sort of use of social media and the internet. And so those are some of the things that kind of come out in this chapter. I do think this one might be one that undergrads in North America could potentially resonate with them a little bit.
Yeah, dick pic is cultural universal. There's something I never thought I'd say, you know.
That's it. I have a chapter, not a section of a chapter about the dick pic. But from a queer male perspective, it takes on a different kind of meaning.
Absolutely, right? I think that's also really important to recognize. We're very specific about the population that we're talking about in terms of their reaction to this. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Okay. So Lisa, I have a couple questions about, because you have two, you have a co-authored chapter and you have a sole authored chapter. This is particularly about your sole authored chapter, about your work among women, doing what could be called sex work. But as you note in your work, there's cultural variations to this term, and you know, it can't always be applied to that same sort of Western idea of exchange for money and sex and goods and sex and this sort of stuff. And so can you tell us a little bit about that chapter?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, these are people who I've known for like literally decades since I've been doing research in Egypt. And when I was first doing my research in Egypt and people would say, that's a prostitute, there's a prostitute, you know, I thought they were saying, oh, that's a sex worker. It literally took me years to realize that they weren't necessarily saying that's a sex worker. They're saying that's like somebody who we're making a judgment about her sexuality, basically, right? And then I eventually came to realize, oh, there, you know, there's sex workers all around me. In a way, I mean, that some of my friends were sex workers, but it's not such an easy, you know, bright identity to it's not an identity that they take on. You know, these are people who have sex for money, and they know that they're doing that, and they say openly that they're doing that, but they don't see themselves as sex workers. I guess one of the reasons is that, you know, these are people who, okay, I guess when we have a stereotype about, you know, the poor lower class prostitute, you know, so I'm using that old stigmatizing word really deliberately, right? Like so often there are these stories about, oh, she's doing it to survive, you know, she was forced into that life. Well, okay, so on one level, some of these people are doing it to supplement their income and maybe even to survive, to survive well. But they are also doing it because they like sex and they like men, you know. And I found that really interesting. These are people who really warmly, humorously embrace their sexuality in different ways. And, you know, I focus the chapter around a couple of women who are who know each other, and one of them is, you know, she loves sex and she'll have sex with a lot of men to support herself and her daughters. Her, you know, ex-husband's a total flake, but she's also periodically getting married to people, you know, and there's this weird in-between category of marriage that we've got somebody else in the volume, Rani Asylum. She also writes about that. I call it, you know, paramarital formations, you know, where you're sort of married, sort of not. You're married, but it's not officially registered. People move in and out of this category of marriage really easily. So she's always getting married to people in part because it provides a kind of a cover for the sex work she's doing. It prevents her from being arrested, in part because she wants to do the right thing, but in part because she's always hoping that one of these marriages will stick and she'll find like the good man who wants to, you know, stay devoted to her and support her and her family. And then, you know, that falls apart eventually. So it's just this really interesting ambiguity. You know, is she a sex worker? Does she want to be married? She wants all of that. And then there's another person who really just doesn't, she won't have sex for money. She'll have sex because she loves somebody or because she wants the pleasure, you know, but then sometimes she kind of has to have sex because she's financially desperate. So I just explore all of those nuances in these people who are really fun and engaging. And God, I mean, they're a hoot to listen to. They own their sexuality in ways that are just really fun and lovely and joyful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And can, you know, another element of that came to my head was, and maybe this is my brain sort of bleeding in with your 2018 book, Love, Sex, Desire in Modern Egypt. But you also talk about how money and that exchange is also part of legitimizing relationships, right? And how, as opposed to something like the West, where we're Vivian Zeilizer, whose work is influential in talking about how money and intimacy sort of were separate. And the minute money comes in, that sort of has an effect of delegitimizing intimacy. Whereas in Egypt, you make a case across your work to look at how that exchange is part of the legitimizing of that relationship. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, Zeilizer is saying, she's basically saying, we have this ideology that money and love don't go together, right? We've got like, money can't buy me love. And we've got all of these cultural sayings that say that they're separate. But Zeilizer actually, she looks at legal histories in the United States. And she says, actually, you know, even though this is the ideology, the reality is that these are closely intertwined. Whereas what I find interesting in Egypt is that, people will readily accept that these things go together, that that's a way that you show love for your partner is you buy them stuff, you know, you support them. And people aren't afraid to own that. And so there's, you know, it happened over and over again that I would meet people who would say, oh yeah, he, you know, in a heterosexual pairing, oh, he doesn't support her, or he doesn't pay for this, he doesn't pay for that, therefore he doesn't really love her. You know, it was seen as proof that he didn't really love her. And I guess one of the things I love, this isn't from our current edited volume, but from my previous book, since you mentioned it, is, you know, a story about like a couple who, yeah, that's what everybody said, like, he doesn't really love her, he doesn't get jealous, he's not paying for this or that. She was a really independent woman who was pursuing a degree in law. Well, now they're happily married. So, you know, and have been for a long time. So clearly the stories that people think that they're telling about other people aren't always true. You know, there's all kinds of interesting subtleties going on. But what's interesting there is that there's that ideology that, yeah, money and love, these things all go together. And that is strange for us. Even if they really go together in our own society and culture, we at least have this ideology that they don't.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay, great. So Mina, thank you for waiting in the wings. I am really happy you could join us. I really was captivated by the story you were telling in your chapter. You wrote about a particular interlocutor, which is a style of writing that I really enjoy and goes along with the vibe of the book. And you wrote about her in a way that felt like I was reading this fascinating, complex, and also sympathetic character in a novel. It was really quite fun to read. And so, you know, can you tell us a little bit about the context of your piece, the person whose journal you were reading, sort of how you came about finding this person, and what brought you toward wanting to analyze her journal as a sort of source of data?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Matthew, for your question. And thanks for having me today. The story that I'm writing in the chapter actually is part of my doctoral fieldwork, doctoral dissertation work, where I trace limits of victimhood and activism narratives among Coptic Christians in Egypt. So my main research question of my dissertation, of my research in general, like, when do Copts as members of a religious minority, or so they are usually described, cannot be called, or cannot call themselves neither victims nor activists, right? So because, like, especially following the 2011 uprisings, you know, many scholars tried to, even before a bit of the 2011 uprisings, many scholars tried to take Copts out of the victimhood, sphere, and put them into being activists through their rituals, traditions, theologies, miracles, saints, apparitions. So they are not just victims of, you know, church bombings or like massacres, as also they are still happening, but at the same time, they have their own, you know, agencies, and they have their own, you know, activist stories to tell. But then when I started my dissertation, I actually was, of course, you know, leaning towards the activist narrative more than the victimhood narrative, as also a member of the 2011 uprisings generation. But then at some point, I have encountered a lot of incidents and stories where the equation includes another concept, actually, which is, which I call in my work, the misfits. So the misfits of the activism and of the victim. People who like are members of the community. Sometimes they are good believers. Sometimes they are actually witnessing miracles. Sometimes they are witnessing saints' apparitions. Sometimes they join street protests to like challenge their marginalization in the country. But at the same time, the same people, there are practices in their lives that cannot, you know, be part of these kind of activist narratives or activist settings, if you want. So, like the girl I'm talking about in the chapter, she's like, I mean, her childhood and her like upbringing is similar to many Coptic Christians, but then her life took different routes because of economic reasons, because also of romantic, you know, reasons, because of her heart was broken as well due to a failed romantic relationship. And then she tells us through her work, or through her, like, what she's doing for work, which is sex work. Actually, she's telling us about careers and sexualities that do not fit into how Copts should act, either as victims or as activists. Yeah.
Like I said, in the piece, the data you're using is sort of interviews with her, but also her journal. You just sort of asked her to be able to access her journal, right? To sort of analyze a bit about the story she was telling in her journal about her sort of sex life and her, you know, her. The sort of biography that she paints through the journal, it's one going all the way down to back to adolescent sexual exploration, heartbreak, like you say, encounters with the church and with morality and stuff with the church. And so can you tell me a little bit about how you approached her journal and how it enabled you to think about these issues that you're raising.
Yeah. So that actually was the issue with the journal, you know, like, so the girl is a church servant, right? She's a lay church servant, which is called in Arabic khadima in the church. And as a khadima, which is also, I myself, I used to be a khadim, which is the, you know, the masculine derivative of the khadima, which is a church layman servant. We actually have in the church what is called the Sunday school preparation notebooks, if you want. So through these notebooks, we prepare our lessons for the kids, right? So she already actually, at the end of each, you know, lesson, so at the lesson, you, of course you are, you know, controlled by the syllabus of the church, you know, but at the end of each lesson, there is this section where you add your own, if you want, spiritual meditation, you know, like a reflection of the story. So, for example, the story of the Samaritan woman, you know, that I mentioned in the chapter, and it's the title of the chapter, actually, is very famous, and it's every year it's taught to kids, you know, at the Sunday schools. And then by the end of each Sunday school preparation notebook, there is this spiritual meditation. But she, actually, the girl I'm talking with in the chapter, and not only her, actually, many of our members of our generation, we actually try to have our own diaries or our own, if you want, notebooks where we can record what we cannot say in the Sunday school preparation notebooks.
It's a wonderful chapter. I encourage you to...
It really is. You know, I was telling, you know, my co-author for the other chapter that I wrote, she's Saudi, Safa Hassanain. I was telling her about Mina's chapter and she's like, wow, that sounds like the plot line of an independent film. I mean, it really is. It's really unconventional, isn't it, Matthew? I mean, that's part of what attracted you to it, I think, right? It's just, it unsettles our ideas about what an academic book chapter is about.
He also just very deftly writes, weaves between the intimate and the sort of the religious, right? The dogmatic, those encounters. And like, I'm not a scholar of religion. And so I wasn't always sure exactly the larger point that he was making because of the connection to the Coptic Church and stuff. But it was such a delight to read the way he writes it.
I'll also just share, at least Lisa and Matthew have both shared some of their comments on it. So my stepfather is Egyptian and is Copt. And I talked to him about your chapter and he is riveted by this. This is obviously the book is just getting released. So we haven't gotten feedback from, you know, really anybody other than the authors, the editors, the people who have done the reviews and like a small number of family members. But one of the things that I think his reflections were to the chapter, and I'm curious about your reaction to this. I'm also curious about how this will get received when the book is released, is that how it is so different from the way that Copts are typically portrayed, whether it's in academic or in media circles, that there's this richness to this chapter and this complexity. And I know you talked about the sort of victim activist divide and how this fits in a very different place, but I think also there's not a whole lot of discussion about Coptic sexuality either that we see in certainly in academic literature, but I think that's even broader. And that really resonated with him. And so when I told him I was doing this podcast and you were on it, he wanted me to express his real delight that this chapter is in the book.
But you might pick up on what Angel was saying about the representation of Copts. I mean, I think that's what's really interesting about your chapter is you say, here's this group of people. I mean, this speaks to the themes of the overall book, too. Here's this group of people who they've got their own lives and dramas and dilemmas. But at the same time, they're always aware of how other people are imagining their lives and dramas and dilemmas. Oh, my God, we just lost Mina again. We just lost his connection anyway. So I think that's part of how his chapter interestingly connects up to the rest of the book is not just that we're looking at these particular practices, lives, experiences, but also the representation of them, this kind of meta level.
I think that's right. I will also just say that I think that one of the other things that kind of comes throughout the book overall, and in some chapters in particular, is sort of the politics of the intimate. And so some of that is around the representation, and some of it is also around, you know, the state and the relationship between the state and intimate personal behaviors. And I think when we talk about the Coptic community in Egypt, I think that Mina does a very good job of sort of recognizing the role that the state is also playing and the politics are actually also playing in the overarching story of this individual woman.
Yeah, so just for the readers, I'll say, you know, this individual woman, so she's a woman who sins. That's how she defines herself. She's somebody who has sinned. So she defines herself as like the Samaritan woman in the Bible, right? And then she's looking around at her community and she's saying, you know, Jesus forgave the Samaritan woman. Why can't you forgive me? Why are you excluding me from your community? And so it's really poignant. You know, she's dealing with stigma and what it means to be ostracized by your own community, in part because of how they judge you, and in part because you're this figure in a broader realm of social politics of what it means to be a Copt in a Muslim majority country. And so there's the state that Angel's talking about too. You know, it's really a complex interweaving of issues that figure into a single woman's sexuality that you do so well, Mina, and welcome back. We lost you again. Can you hear us? Oh no, he's still not here. He's not totally with us. I think we should just give up on Mina's internet connection, unfortunately.
Oh my gosh, poor thing. I will also say it's always hard to know when a book is released what reviewers are going to pick up on. But I suspect strongly that Mina's chapter is going to be one of the things that that when the book gets reviewed, people are going to focus on, both because of the overarching content, but again, I think it is just such a different way of engaging with an interlocutor and the kind of data that he using someone else's journal as this way of bringing forth a story is not something we see very often. So I think there's actually a really fascinating kind of methodologic contribution as well. So I would predict that's the chapter that when this book gets reviewed, reviewers are going to focus on. I could be totally wrong, but you know, I'll throw that out there if I had to wager money.
You know, who do you think should read this book but likely won't?
Oh, geez, that's a hard question.
Political pundits, maybe.
My husband, who never reads any of the academic stuff I write. I could tell, like, terrible stories about him. He'd never know.
I think about, you know, going back to our conversation about the introduction and the frame and what the text is trying to do. I think that there's tons of people, you know, people who make policy, people who make decisions about governing the Middle East, about reproductive care, about healthcare, about, you know, global activists. Although they might read the book, it's, you know, it's the pundits and the politicians who really need a nuanced understanding of sexuality in the MENA that probably won't read it. Mina, welcome back. Do you want to have the final, do you want to sort of have a final say about your text and your approach to it and, you know, what you think the significant contributions are?
No, thanks. I'm sorry again for this. And just to answer Angel's, I don't know if you hear me, but I was just to answer Angel's note, I barely heard it actually. Yes, it's about actually the representation. That's the can you hear me? Yeah, just the representation issue, because that's the thing about the whole point about what I was writing in the chapter actually, that this figure that I'm writing about is not only a misrepresentation of the community, but she is actually refuted, actually to be even evaluated as either a representative or a misrepresentative of the community. So that's also something important, that she is actually, people like her actually are not only refuted by the community within the community, but also when it also are rejected or are kind of negated also in what is called, between brackets, critical academic studies, and also in critical think tanks as well that investigate the Coptic, what's called Coptic rights or minority rights. So women like her or girls like her are not even considered as people who can speak, you know, not only on behalf of the Coptic community, but also on behalf of even of, you know, girls in her age or even members who even have the same lives within the community, Coptic community in particular, and Egypt in general, as well with respect to these victimhood and activist narratives, as I mentioned.
Anyway, I, you know, that's all my questions. If anyone has any sort of final words to say, I'm really excited for the release of the text in what, 2 or 3 days, I think. It's going to be officially available. Does anyone want to have the final word?
I don't know that it needs to be final. I'm certainly happy for Lisa to give final word on the book, but I would just want to say one thing about that. What's this project has spurred on kind of the next project. And one of the things that really came out of this project was a kind of a different way of thinking about field work, especially sort of deep ethnographic work. And one of the things that we found, you know, we talked about this in the context of Mina's chapter, but also some of the other chapters where, yes, some of that was about sort of classic anthropological ethnographic methods, but we're seeing much more engagement with social media, interacting over social media, doing virtual interviews, things like that, being engaged with communities in very different ways. So I think the next project that Lisa and I are excited about is really thinking about a book about doing field work in the Middle East and North Africa that really starts to explore kind of field work in a more contemporary era. And again, really recognizes that field work means very different things depending on someone's relationship with the community that they're working in. And so field work for someone is about living in their own community and what it means to study one's own community and oneself. But that can also mean somebody who's embedded or in a period, in a place for a shorter period of time, and really trying to bring that together. In my experience, and I say this now as a professor with graduate students, I feel like some of the sort of field work literature out there is a little dated and doesn't recognize, I would say, especially in anthropology, some of the newer ways that people are engaging with interlocutors. So this project has really inspired us to look at that more formally.
Great.
Yeah. And I'll say, you know, one of the things people are always asking me is, oh my God, how did you get to do that research? And so that's something that we can address, you know, these complicated ways that people embed themselves into a community and find a legitimate role to be anthropologists. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just
I agree.
To add very quick thing about this, about also how do you do this research? Because I think, as also Lisa mentioned, I think at the beginning or hinted at, as a researcher, I learned from the people during my field work how to do this research, like through their, how they are maneuvering, you know, their banned or negated sexualities or sexual lives. I actually learned from them how to do it, how to do the research, how to write about it, you know. So it's very interesting that really developing these you know, ethnographic, if you want, tactics, you know, from the people, and actually that even can these tactics actually should expand even the ethical considerations or limited ethical considerations that we are faced with in our Western universities. So really, I learned a lot from my interlocutors about their tactics and how to apply them actually while writing and while doing my research.
Wonderful. Well, thanks everyone for conversing with me today.
Thank you so much for having us, Matthew.
Thanks, Matthew.